This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Stage, Paul Blizzard with Malachy Talek and Travis Elborough.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Can you hear? Oh, that's better. I can hear myself now. Can you see them from where you're sitting? Yes? Just about, if you crane your head. This is, okay, here's a weird thing about what we're going to talk about for the next 45 minutes with your help and questions from you after about half an hour. Obviously, you guys are here, one would imagine, to have a look and see what's available, where you're going to go for your summer holidays, to come and choose your summer holiday, find the location that you want to go to, discover new places. Most of the talks that we do sitting from this stage are about places that you can go to, spoken about by somebody that's been there. So Simon Reeve earlier on, for those of you that were here earlier, was talking about Turkey. In the past, he's talked about Greece. Leveson Wood was talking about walking around Central America. The slight difference with this one is what's so genius about the Stamfords Travel Writing Festival is that both Malachy and Travis have written about places that you pretty much either can't go to because they're imaginary islands, or places that you wouldn't want to because they're so foul-ridden and pestilent or stuffed full of asbestos, it's the last place on earth you'd want to go to. So what we're going to do, but if there is a central theme of these two books, which are fantastic pieces of travel writing, aside from anything else, is that they're both about islands, whether imaginary or improbable. So we're going to sort of start talking about the nature of what islands mean in our psyche. And Malachy, because your superb book is about the imagined islands, what did your research into writing this sort of teach you about how islands exist as a state of mind, let alone as a geographical location? Is that a good place to start?
Yeah.
It's a little bit esoteric. Do with it what you will.
Well, I think many people are fascinated. Many people are fascinated by islands or obsessed by islands. Can you hear me? Nope. Some people can hear me, some can't.
Can we have a bit more level on Malachy, please?
Yeah.
So it's getting hot.
Okay. Is that any better? No.
Keep talking, Malachy, and the guys on the sound desk will sort you out.
Okay. Is that any better now? Is it going to change?
Sorry about the technical hitch. Is his mic pack not working, or... Thank you, buddy.
Okay. Hopefully that's better. You can hear me now?
Okay. Thank you. Thumbs up from the back.
So, where were we? Islands. Yeah, I think many people are fascinated by islands and by the idea of islands. And a big part of that is the simple geographical fact that they are disconnected from other places. And therefore, they have that sense of distance and very much their own identity. But also people can kind of impose their own imaginings on those places. They can be like other worlds within our own world. And there is something endlessly fascinating about that. I mean, I was the editor of an online magazine called The Island Review. And that is writing from and about islands. And there is just this amazing appetite from people everywhere for information about islands and stories about islands and pictures of islands. It just it seems to be almost a universal fascination, I think.
There's something rather apt about a man such as yourself who grew up on Shetland, famously a selection of islands, and then lived on Fair Isle, an incredibly remote island, writing about islands, and I kind of like that tie-up. But can you talk us about how the starting point for this book, which is imagined islands, you're writing about places that we can never go to other than through reading about them, their existence in the minds of other people.
Yeah, I mean, it's an odd subject, I suppose. The book came about from my previous book, 60 Degrees North. I wrote a chapter for that book about two islands, Thule and Friesland, which at one time or another were believed to lie at 60 degrees north of the equator. And the chapter didn't quite fit within the rest of the book. I wasn't happy with it. But I loved the idea of these places that existed only in the mind and not in reality, places that you couldn't go to, but which you could explore in other ways, in stories. And when I began kind of doing research for this book, I found that these, in fact, existed all over the world. There were these different types of islands, whether it be mythical islands or mistakes by sailors or cartographers or frauds. So there were all these different kinds of islands that exist in one way but not another, I suppose.
Let's just before we come to Travis, can you give us a little snapshot of two of the islands you've written about? One, a classical one. So let's use Thule, because you've mentioned that before, which I now know how to say. Apparently it's not Thule, but it is Thule, which could have been Shetland or Iceland. And then can you talk us through the Antarctic islands that were thought to be there until very recently and have been proven not to be? So the classical relevance of Thule, which was kind of Thule Ultima, the end of the world.
Yeah, well, Thule is a very interesting one. It was supposed to be discovered by a Greek explorer called Pytheas in the 3rd century BC. He was one of the first Greeks to travel far north. He went through Britain, and then he went beyond to a place that he called Thule, which he said was 6 days north of Britain. And he wrote a book about that voyage, and unfortunately the book has been lost, so all we know about it are scraps of writing from other people's books. And from those scraps, it's really quite unclear where exactly he was talking about. Nobody can be certain. The Romans thought that Shetland was Thule, and the name has been attached to Shetland sometimes. There's a pub in Lerwick called The Thule, which was a very fascinating place for me when I was growing up. But more often, Thule was attached to Iceland. If you look at lots of maps in medieval times, you'll see the name Iceland and Thule together there. And then eventually the name disappears. So it was a name without a place, in a sense, which is very interesting. The Antarctic islands, there were actually lots of islands in Antarctica which were discovered and then undiscovered again. They happened not to be there. And the most recent were the Terra Nova Islands, which were discovered by Philip Law, who's a very famous Australian Antarctic explorer. He found them in the 1960s. He was a very reliable man. As far as eyewitnesses go, he described these islands in his journals, and they were accepted. They were put on the map. But when German scientists went back to the same area in the 1980s, they had a helicopter with them on board their ship. They went looking for these islands, and they weren't there. Couldn't find them anywhere. So presumably this great explorer had been deceived by icebergs or something else. Who knows? That's one of the very interesting things about these islands, is that sometimes you don't know what happened. It's impossible to know now how these places ended up on the map, who exactly made the mistake and why.
Right. Nicely described. Travis, I realise I've done you a little bit of a disservice, because your book is not actually about islands.
It's not solely islands. There is an island in it.
There are a few islands, actually.
But being the
atlas of improbable places, they are sort of islands of imagination, because you have subterranean places. There is a sense of other, detachment of so much of what you've written about.
Some of those places have that geographical or geological otherness about it. But to take an island like the Kingdom of Redonda, for example, which is the island itself exists. It's just off Montserrat. It's a rather unimpressive piece of land, but through the sort of claiming of it by the father of the science fiction writer M.P. Scheele, he then sort of ended up having this kingship. And M.P. Scheele, when he eventually left the Caribbean and settled in London and sort of made his way as a writer, eventually created this literary dynasty around this island of Redondo. So in a way, it has a physical reality, and then it has a kind of mythic reality. And I think that's something that both Malachy and myself's books explore in a way. And Malachy has a great line in his book about saying that just because they're mythic doesn't mean they're real. And in my case, in a way, my improbable places, many of them are real, but they seem mythic, or they could be a piece of fiction. And also, a few of my improbable places have been created, like Auroraville in India, under the idea of sort of a utopian ideal. So they're partly about a different type of imagination creating these kind of odd places. So that idea of fiction and will and fulfilment kind of merges into some of these improbable places. And one of my favourite places in the book, as far as just being a somewhat unpleasant place to look at, but rather compelling all the same, Battleship Island in Japan, which is this kind of rotted former mining settlement that most people will know from its appearance in Skyfall, the James Bond film, where it serves as the lair of the villain. Now, that was a real place. It was a mining settlement, and then it was kind of abandoned and left, and has kind of rotted, and has now become this incredible sort of tourist attraction, because it has all these sort of jack-o'-lantern tower blocks that are just kind of slowly rotting away.
Extraordinary place, now completely deserted. Obviously, we're not going to be able to go through all the you have some fantastic places in your atlas of improbable places, but can we focus on a couple just to give some insights into how you chose them and what your selection sort of bright process was. Can you talk us through Slab City in the States, which is an extraordinary place?
It is. I mean, Slab City, again, is a quasi-utopian settlement. It's out in the on a piece of former army, sort of abandoned army land called Camp Dunlop, I think is what it was originally called. And it's gradually been colonised by off-gridders, some more unsavoury characters, shall we say, but also people kind of looking for some haven from often financial insecurity and stuff. So it has all these. It has a kind of a community centre. It has a stage where they have kind of weekly concerts. It has bars. Most extraordinary of all, given it's in the desert of California, and the slabs are just these abandoned bits of concrete. When you go there, you expect the slabs. The slabs are taken as a bit of a given, in the same way maybe that on Treasure Island you expect to find the treasure. But I have to say, the golf course was something of a kind of more of a surprise. They have a kind of, it doesn't have any grass, and it mainly involves a kind of pitching and putting balls along the scrub desert. But it's this idea of it's the kind of last frontier of the American West in a way.
It is extraordinary. I mean, even new places build up there. You get these concretions of their own mythology, which tend to be sort of completely implied by society or imposed by society. So, there's another place that springs to mind. Of course, Port Marion springs to mind here in the UK. And I'm sure have many people here been to Port Marion in North Wales? Yeah. So we don't need to talk about that because you know about it. But there's an American, not quite equivalent, but an American man that tried to recreate Stonehenge.
There is. He was
completely implausible.
A character called Samuel Hill, who was a Quaker businessman and entrepreneur. He very reluctantly, and this is in the early part of the late 19th, early part of the 20th century, very reluctantly, when America entered the First World War, found himself conflicted, but in the end supported America entering the First World War. At the end of the First World War, though, he wanted to create a peace monument, which actually many people did across the world. Now, he thought in a way that many lives had been lost, sacrificed for the cause of freedom during the First World War. And owing slightly to a misunderstanding in his knowledge about the nature of Stonehenge, he assumed that Stonehenge had been the site of human sacrifices.
Right.
So in order to create a fitting memorial to the fallen war dead of the First World War, he decided to create a scale replica model of Stonehenge out of concrete in Washington State. And it exists to this day. Because it was made out of concrete and was cast out of these sort of big stone blocks, it's a little smooth, a little tidy. It's a complete circle. It's like what Stonehenge would have looked like when it was perhaps first created. The other thing it completely fails on is it's on the wrong side of the stones are slightly in the wrong place, so it doesn't work as an astrological star chart in the way that the original Stonehenge does.
So the solstices don't factor into it at all.
But it looks rather were amazing, perched on the top of this hill in Washington State, with the river kind of below it, and this absolute replica of Stonehenge called Mary Hill, named after his daughter.
See, I was expecting when I was reading the piece that you'd written about, I was expecting the word folly to appear.
Yes, yeah,
but it doesn't.
Not in that particular piece. No, I think the war memorial element means it has a purpose. It's not entirely for kind of Detroit way. I mean, but Paul Miriam obviously has lots of, is a kind of an architectural folly, but a very lovely one.
Malachy, I want to come back to you. Obviously, this is the Stamford's Travel Writing Festival. It says clearly over there, the writing and the travel are the important bits of those words. How do you go about writing about places that, one, don't exist, and two, you can't travel to? I'm not questioning your right to be here. Don't mistake what I'm saying. But I'm intrigued how you get yourself into the headspace of writing about fictional places.
Well, I wrote this book immediately after finishing my previous book, which was a travel book, for which I had to go to lots of new and different places. And I began writing this one as soon as that was finished. And in a sense, it was a huge relief to be able to do my research in the library and on the internet and not have to go to all of these places. But it was difficult in lots of ways, particularly with the subject matter. When you're writing about places that don't exist, trying to establish facts, which you have to do, is quite tricky. How do you know the true story of a place which isn't really there? And often when you're doing the research, when I was doing the research, there were numerous different versions of the story. And I had to kind of pick through them and sometimes just decide which I thought was the most plausible. So there were real difficulties. I think I say somewhere in the book, how do you establish facts about phantoms? There were real challenges in that.
Travis, I'm guessing you didn't go to all the places that are in your atlas. It would have taken you a lifetime to visit them.
I mean, there are a couple which I wouldn't in any circumstance visit.
Town in Australia, to begin with.
Yes, exactly. A particular famous example in the book is a place called Wittenoom. I don't know if anyone's familiar with this, which was a centre of asbestos, blue asbestos mining town, before really people understood the damage and the carcinogenic nature of asbestos. And there are some absolutely heartbreaking photographs of people living in Wittenoom at that time, children playing with asbestos as if it's sand.
That's right. And
it's effectively been taken off the map. It was taken off the map in about 2007, but it's kind of a lethal place. And there's a song by the Australian band Midnight Oil, which pays tribute to the miners and their children and their family who lost their lives from Wittenoom, called Blue Sky Mining. So some of those places are ones I wouldn't necessarily wish anyone to visit either, for the good of their own health.
Of those that you weren't able to visit in prior to writing this book, which of them would you particularly like to go to?
I think I'd absolutely love to go. It's the most, in a sense, it's the most idyllic of island places, and that's Palmerston, which is one of the Cook Islands, right. Which has the curious distinction of both being very, very beautiful, lush land where, teeming with fish. Apparently, the seas around there are practically described as being like a kind of a larder. You practically just put your net in and grab food out of them, and there are palm trees, you name it, all of the attributes of a beautiful island. But mysteriously, all of the inhabitants of Palmerston are related to one man and his three, I think, or possibly four wives, a man called William Masters, who was basically set on the island as a caretaker and was a devout Christian and set about kind of peopling the island in a slightly Old Testament way with his four wives.
A lot of begatting.
Exactly. And people can visit the island and stay on the island, but the only permanent residents on the island are related to the Masters.
And why do you want to go there?
Because it's this idyllic, beautiful kind of the island place, really.
Superb. Malachy, of the of the mythical islands that you've written about is the one that stands out. You think, if only it did exist, if only there was an earthly paradise like this here on our planet.
Well, there's one of the islands that is in some ways similar. It's a tropical paradise in the Pacific, and it was called Onassus, renamed Hunter's Island by Captain Hunter, who supposedly discovered it. And what he found there was this kind of paradise island inhabited by very friendly native people who welcomed them, gave them all kinds of gifts, and they described it as being a volcanic island. But the next time that somebody went looking for it, they couldn't find it. And so for a long time it was thought that this volcanic island had erupted and disappeared. But my suspicion is, unfortunately, that Captain Hunter invented this island to make himself famous and get his name temporarily on the map. It's almost just too good to be true. The details are just too perfect. And there are some odd little details too as well. He describes the people there having 40-foot spears. And I was trying to think about what possible use a 40-foot spear could actually be, and I couldn't think what you would use one for. But so I think this
long
is one
distance
of
distance killing.
Yeah. Sort of, yeah. This is one of these invented fake islands that it would be nice if it was there.
I mean, there's a strong literary tradition of people inventing islands.
Of course.
You know, from obviously Robinson Crusoe, Treasure Island to Coral Island and so on and so forth. There's something about the island mentality that resonates very heavily in our psyches.
Well, it goes back to that idea, I think, of an island as another world. It's a way to create another world without making it science fiction, I suppose.
Mm. But I mean, Thomas More's Utopia is an island, you know, somewhere in the newfound world, isn't it? So I think there's an element of, because it's self-contained as well, the island is cut off from everything else. In narrative terms as well, you can kind of people it in the same way that Masters did on Palmerston.
Yeah, quite
so,
a good point.
So the whole thing lends itself to a whole. It is a world, as you say, and it's a self-contained world.
Do you think there's something about the, sort of the human scale of thing as well, that actually the world is so big we can barely conceive it in our heads, but something that has highly definable borders and edges, where there's a cut between land and sea, in our own human psyches, we can handle that. Like, we can visualise what 10 eggs looks like, but how can you visualise actually what a million eggs looks like? You can't, so make, you know.
I mean, even in that idea of kind of, you know, difficult point in these days, but national identity.
Yes,
the idea, in a way, that if you were an island, it makes it a lot easier to think, okay, that's Britain, even though, of course, for a long time, part of, you know, Calais was in Britain.
Absolutely.
So, well, yes, which is why if you ask a Shetlander what is your national identity, generally they'll say, I'm a Shetlander. Yeah. They won't say, I'm Scottish. Yeah. Their identity is an island-based rather than a national-based one.
And yet more so for Faroese or Orcadians, Icelands.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, that is it. And of course, there's another thing about the survival aspect. I don't know if you know this, but there's, given what's happened politically over the last 12 months or so, there's been a massive, in posh, highly wealthy estate agents, a lot of inquiries coming from billionaires and oligarchs for private islands to be bought for their own survival purposes. And there's been a lot of press over the last week about people buying apartments in nuclear bunkers. But there's been this same thing, you know, if you happen to be in Greece, or if you're the Greek government right now, there is a lot of pressure for them to sell smaller islands to wealthy individuals, because there's a containable sort of survival cell phone, which I find extremely odd.
Well, if anyone is interested in and has a spare £250,000, there is an island for sale in Shetland at the moment, I think called Hevre, which is, it's about 2 acres, nothing on it whatsoever, just a completely barren island. If you've got the money, you know.
Who owns it? Who's selling it?
I presume a crofter. It would just have been part of their craft. And
any billionaires out there today, that's where you go and survive. You could set yourself up a stall, sell £50 lottery tickets, and when you've hit the right number, you can make a fortune. Actually, talking about islands, Venice, of course, famously a selection of islands in a lagoon. An island, the Italian government sold the old leper colony.
Paveglia.
That's it. I've read about this in your book. Tell us about this. It's extraordinary. Yeah.
Well, the word that we have, quarantine, comes from the sort of Venetian term for where people not being allowed into the city-state of Venice would be put up on an island outside Venice for 40 days until the plague had passed. So Paveglia was the old plague station, and then it became an insane asylum. And now finally it has been sold, and there are plans to turn it into a luxury hotel. So in a way, it's the first time in about 400 years that anyone would choose to go to this place rather than being banished for disease or mental insanity.
And you could have a 5-star hotel built on the bones or the cremated remains or the buried remains. But what astonished me about that, and forgive me, I've just realized you've caught me out for telling you the story that I'd learned from you by reading your book to begin with, that the island was sold for just 400,000 euros or something crazy.
It was pretty cheap.
Seems pretty cheap, exactly. Time for questions from you guys. I think we have a man with a microphone somewhere. Where's he gone? Oh, that's right. Here we go. Let's do that. We have a lady here. Thank you very much, Roddy.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So I was wondering, Malachy, you've written about islands that don't exist. Forgive me because I'm not familiar with your career to date, but I wondered if you were perhaps tempted to go in the direction of fiction, having come from writing, about real places. Perhaps this is a stopping off point on the way to fiction.
Well, it's a good guess because my first book was a travel book. The second was a book about islands that don't exist, and I'm just finishing up a novel at the moment. So I did go on to write about fiction. It's set in Shetland, but it is fictional.
Does it involve any travel?
No, in fact the opposite. It's the novel is entirely contained within a small valley, a small community in a small valley in Shetland. It's very much tightly contained. That's what I wanted to write about that.
So you created a very small social island within a slightly larger geographical island.
Yeah.
How extraordinary. Another question. Do you have any more questions? Well spotted. Thanks, Roddy.
Keeping fit.
He can run.
Yeah.
So you've done a lot of research into different islands that don't exist. Do you think there's a chance that there are still islands out there that haven't been discovered?
Ah, now that's a really good question. In the days of satellite imagery, when we can pretty much see the whole of the planet from remote sensing?
It is an interesting one, and there have been very small rocks, essentially, that have been discovered. I mean, the thing about satellite imagery is that we can now see every part of the world, but nobody's necessarily looking at those images. No human is scanning those images. The last island that I talk about in here is called Sandy Island, which was only undiscovered in 2012. It actually appeared on Google Earth, although it wasn't there in reality. And in fact, until a few months ago, you could still search it on Google Earth. If you typed in Sandy Island, it would take you to the outline of this island that was not there. Unfortunately, in the last few months, they've changed that. The outline is still there, but it's not on the search engine, so you can still go and find it. But to be honest, I doubt there are places, there are islands left to be discovered, unless there are ones that come out from under the ice in the Arctic, I suppose. That's one possibility.
But I think it's an interesting, the idea of technology full stop. I mean, one of the things about my book, The Improbable Places idea, is, are there any interesting places left out there now that we kind of contract them all and everything else? And also the other thing about satellites, the earliest kind of travel maps looked to the sky and the stars for their charting. So in some respects, we've always come full circle, though the mystery of the, here be dragons has rather been replaced by, here be a familiar shopping centre or even whatever part of the world you're
in. Here be Waitrose.
Yeah.
But I think there's quite a big thing today about trying to find your own kind of adventure and mysterious places. There's this sort of urban exploring that people do, going into abandoned buildings and things like that. I know in Glasgow there's at least two or three metro stations no longer used, and people kind of break in and find their way down into there. So although in some ways everywhere's mapped and everywhere's explored, there are still places that you can kind of find adventure and get off the map in some way, as it were.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that about the buildings, because there's a man called Austin here who's a filmmaker who's married to the previous speaker, who has spent his time motorcycling around continental Europe, staying in abandoned buildings in the former Soviet Union. Stick your hand up, Austin. There he is, over there. But of course, your point's a good one, because of course, the gentleman that asked the last question, because the chance of us finding undiscovered places, if, unlike Trump, we believe in global warming, is going to get much less, because even a lot of the places that we do know about that are low-lying, like Bangladesh and the Maldives and so on, are going to be disappearing over the next 20 to 50 years to everyone who you believe. So the sad truth is that if there are any low-lying islands that Google Earth has spotted but we haven't actually bothered to do, you know, to find yet, we're probably not going to see them. We're probably never going to go there.
But there are other things, like the retreat of the Aral Sea.
Yes.
It means that a new landmass is coming into existence, which that could be the... There could be new islands in the sense that the seas...
Oh, that's a nice point. Yes, I like that.
There are islands that naturally disappear and appear through volcanic eruptions or other various kind of geological factors. And Iceland is one place where that has happened numerous times. Islands have come and gone, including islands that were inhabited and farmed, in fact, between Iceland and Greenland. And one day they were there and the next day they were gone.
Mystical, magical. Another question. Please, madam.
Hello. A two-part question, but it may be the same answer. What's the favourite island of yours that you've been to? And what's your favourite improbable place that you've been to?
Favourite island that you've been to, and the second one was favourite
improbable place. For me.
Okay,
yeah.
Fine.
Yeah.
My favourite island is Fair Isle, which is one of the Shetland Islands between Orkney and Shetland. And I lived there for 3 years. It's an island that now has about 55 people living on it. It was a little more when I was there, 60, 65. And it's remote. It's quite a long way from Shetland and a very long way from big centres of population. But it's a very, very beautiful place and an incredible community, an incredibly welcoming, open community where you have the opportunity to do things that you wouldn't do elsewhere. When I lived there, I went there not knowing how I was going to earn a living. And I started out learning to knit Fair Isle knitwear. And then I got a job in the school. And then I got a job doing road work. And I got a job on the ferry. And I kept sheep. And so everybody's kind of the same. They have all of these different small incomes that make up their livelihood, I suppose. And it's an incredible place to visit, and it's an incredible place to live as well. It was a real privilege.
Just as a writer, forgive me, Travis, but what made it so incredible? Why did you like it so much when, to most people who are used to super-fast broadband, Waitrose delivery, the ability to jump in a car and drive to wherever the hell they want to go, the sort of lifestyle you're talking about is completely 180 degrees around from that. What makes that attractive?
In one word, it is community, I suppose. It's living amongst people that you know well and that you care about and you know care about you, and you know that they're looking out for you. And some people find that intolerable. They find it claustrophobic, the idea that everybody knows your business, everybody knows what you're doing day to day, and they can't deal with that. But I didn't have that experience. Some people love that feeling of closeness. I don't want to say it's exactly like a big family, but it's a bit like that.
Sorry, Travis, I cut across your answer.
No, I mean, It's such a tricky one. I mean, because we mentioned, I mean, I inclined, almost my favourite has to be the Mary Hill, the concrete Stonehenge. But in a similar part of the world, I would have to nominate a slightly different thing, which is Hearst's Castle at San Simeon, which is Ranulph Hearst, the great newspaper magnate and the basis for Orson Welles' Citizen Kane, had his kind of his own sort of Xanadu. And it's now a kind of a public museum. But it, you know, it's this monstrously bizarre, strange wonder clamour of architectural treasures sort of looted from around Europe. So there are you know, medieval barns, there are pseudo-Roman baths, there are original 14th century Italian Renaissance fittings inside these huge, huge rooms. There are swimming pools. It's essentially... You imagine someone saying, you know, if money was no object, how would I live? This is what it would look like.
Didn't he? Aren't the stuff that he imported, the stones that he took down buildings, imported them out to California, and then just couldn't be bothered to put them back together again?
He had two warehouses. He had a whole warehouse in Brooklyn that was just full of stuff. And after his death. I think there's a barn which ended up in Abyssinia, California, about 20 years after it had been packed away. I mean, he was almost a kind of like a Michael Jackson figure. You know, like the world was like one big toy shop as far as his purchasing goes. But his fascination was for you know, European stuff from, you know, it's from centuries past.
It's like he'd gone on the grand tour and brought everything back that he saw and liked.
This is true. He actually went on a grand tour with his mother as a small boy, age about 12 or 13. And really, you can see every act he did after that was an attempt to recreate that tour. I mean, an absolutely incredible.
It is possible to have too much money, and William Randolph Hearst is the proof. Yeah. Just, do we have any more questions? Would anybody else like to ask a question, either of Travis or Maliki?
Can I be nosy and ask something?
Please, Ronnie,
I wanted to ask about someone who loves the story of Odysseus, whether or not Ithaca and Circe's Island and all the others, whether they did exist, whether they've ever existed, whether they could be found, or whether or not they are entirely fictional.
Who's the classicist?
Somebody else, I'm sure, knows the answer to this better than me. As far as I'm aware, there is still disagreement about that question. It is assumed that some of the islands, at least, must be based on real ones. But I don't think there is agreement about where is where, if you see what I mean.
Actually, you raise a good point there, Ronnie. Can we just discuss this just for a second while we've still got a few more minutes? How would the two of you define quality in travel writing? What makes for good travel writing, whether it's Homer's Odyssey or whether it's a certain Mr. Palin, who I think people are queuing up to see very shortly? What makes
it has to be good writing, doesn't it?
Just good
writing. I mean, that sounds a really odd thing to say, but you know, it's the thing of the journey, whether, you know, sometimes, you know, I mean, like Thesiger, for example, you know,
sure.
The sense and the tacticity you get of the environment, the land, and everything he's encountering—that, you know—that's absolutely incredible. But you know, occasionally you do want something that's, you know, maybe a Bryson which can, you know, approaches the world with a certain degree of wit, amusement, almost bemusement. I mean, Jeff Dyer, for example,
yes.
that travel writing away which is almost anti-travel. You know, everywhere he goes to, practically, he's immensely disappointed by. You know, goes and sees the Northern Lights, and, you know, not that bothered really. Would rather stay in, you know. And so, you know, sometimes, in a way, it's the same with kind of, you know, Maliki's book and some elements of mine as well. It's that thing of sometimes the travel itself is not that interesting, or in a way, it's what the person brings to that story.
Quite.
And that's the same for all of us, isn't it? We come with our own baggage and our own stories that we attach. I mean, Alan de Botton in The Art of Travel book said, you know, I'd made the mistake, I'd brought myself with me on holiday. That idea that, you know, you can't slough off your own personality. And I think that the great travel writing in a way has both empathy and interest and humanity for the world it's describing, but also it can come with its own baggage and psychological quirks.
Actually, I like that. If you put a good storyteller in a dull situation, they'll still come back with a good story.
Yeah.
Put a bad storyteller in a great situation, they'll still come up with a bad story.
Yeah.
Maliki.
Absolutely. And I'm going to be boring in a sense and agree with Travis, because there is no recipe, I think, for great travel writing. Every writer will approach a different situation in a different way. Yeah. And a good writer can make a very boring journey fascinating. And as you say, a bad writer, it doesn't matter where you take them, it's not going to be worth reading.
I mean, the really interesting example of that is the Jonathan Raven's Coasting and Theroux's Kingdom of the Sea, where they both find out essentially that they're doing a tour around the coast of Britain, and both of them meet at one point, and they both books have a description of the meeting while doing this book about the coast of Britain. Uh-huh. So it's kind of, you know, really...
And whose is the better description?
They both offer very different approaches.
Takes, yeah, so, absolutely. And, you know, of course, there is that thing about I've always thought a flaw in travel writing, which comes back to the old Chinese problem that you can't step into the same river twice, that each of us could write about being here today, and somebody could take it away tonight and read it, and then all think, oh, I'll go there, that sounds good, but then you come here tomorrow, it's a completely different thing.
I, in a sense, that's one of the things that I was trying to explore in this book. I'm fascinated by the idea that there are many layers to travel. Travel is not, it's never just about the things that you see and hear and experience when you're in a place. Travel is always partly about the anticipation, and yeah, then it's partly about the memories when you've left yeah there. Your journey is shaped by these different layers. And so the fact that the places in my book can't actually be visited doesn't mean that you can't experience them.
Quite.
You can have this kind of anticipation through the stories that exist around them. There is this world that exists around these places that do not exist.
Nicely put. There we shall have to leave it. Thank you to you for coming. Thanks for being here. I hope you're having a lovely day as travel exhibitionists. And thank you to Travis and thank you to Maliki. And if you do feel so inclined, they'll be signing their books over there. They make a really nice pair of books because one is, of course, places that do exist. One is a bunch of places that don't exist. But they are both very fine writers. And I'm looking forward to reading your novel, Maliki. Would you please give great thanks to Travis Elbra and Maliki Talak? Thank you very much indeed. Bless you, gentlemen.